we're building up to what it does mean. It can mean that a person is more committed to the service of Christ and His church than the generality of Christians are expected to be. This more can be a matter of duration. It can be a matter of exclusivity. That is, that a person will dedicate him or herself beyond what is expected to the service of the church. And this, by the way, can apply to both religious and others. Are there lay people who give their lifetime to the service of the church? Yes. That's more than is expected of the generality of the faithful. Again, it can mean that a person is more ready to accept suffering which comes to him unbidden from the hands of God. That is, more than he would have to satisfy his duty as a Christian. And God, as we know, does send some people sufferings which He does not send others. We are talking across a very broad spectrum, addressing ourselves to a theological analysis of what generosity means. There is such a thing as a vocation to suffering. And what a difference it makes if those who have received the suffering see it as a call to generosity. It can mean that a person is actually eager, and the word must be used, eager, to even seek the cross that God makes available. That's not a passing phrase, that God makes available. Even though, absolutely speaking, he would not seem to be more virtuous in doing so. This will call for some explanation. This is the explanation that the great masters of the spiritual life, notably Ignatius, whom I have studied, I guess, more than others, not guess, more than all the others. Even though there is no question of sin, that's obvious, but even, and this is hard to grasp, all we've got to do is say it. Even though, strictly speaking, by the person's choice of the cross, he will not seem to be any more virtuous. So then, what's the reason? Well, that's the mystery. The reason is not the practice of virtue. The reason is the love of God in the person of Christ. So it's no longer on an ethical level when you cannot see the person is, well, practicing more patience or whatever. And even though, and this is really something, Ignatius says, even though the glory that I would give to God would be the same between two actions, A and B, yet I should, with God's grace, dispose myself to prefer the second action, which has more of the cross in it, even though, now we must say theologically, contrary to fact, because God would be more glorified by my very desire to love Him more. But nevertheless, from my viewpoint, that's not the reason. that this is going to be a more perfect action. Forget it. God is going to be more glorified. I don't know and I don't care. All I know is that this action will make me more like my Master. Now, before we leave this, let me add some clarification. Evidently, we are here at the apex of generosity. And notice, we are not excluding, on the contrary, we are including all the other generosities. Clear? So we are not to, for a moment, suspect that only this is generosity with God. Oh, no. Secondly, this apex of generosity is an attitude. It is not as such an action. I cannot stress that too much. It's an attitude. But a very precious attitude to have, because believe me, we won't have to wait too many days before, if we have the attitude, we will be given an opportunity to reduce it to action. Agreed? And the problem, even with those who have consecrated themselves to a lifetime of generosity, which we are not underestimating, can settle down for a mediocrity, which then is mediocrity because it is not inspired by this attitude, as you can tell, and they are the first ones to tell you. All sorts of concessions they're making to that kind of total giving of themselves, which a person who has this attitude will not fail when the action comes to put it into practice. This kind of generosity, and notice, I want to repeat, I have five types of generosity, and that was the fifth. They are all generosity, but I prepared myself, or yourselves, for saying that built into the concept of generosity is the notion of levels, right? Degrees. There's a more and a more and a more and a more. And each level can already be a more beyond the previous level. But this kind of generosity carries with it the willingness and, in fact, the desire to become as Christ-like as possible. And it's the as possible that's the clincher. For no other reason than the desire to be assimilated to Jesus, who used his freedom, and that we have already seen as part of generosity, used his freedom to prefer poverty, humiliation, and suffering, even though he might have, absolutely speaking, redeemed the world without the cross. A passion, then, is not just a long narrative, happens to be the longest for the time span in the Gospels. It is a revelation of the highest degree of human generosity towards God in the person of a man called Jesus of Nazareth, who is so in love with God that he chose this way of showing his love, even though the world could have been redeemed without it. Well, but there is a logic behind it. The logic is that while the world might have been redeemed without the cross, we must say it would not have been sanctified without the cross. Don't forget that, sisters. In other words, the merits that Christ gained for the world by His dying on the cross could have been, as we know, been gained by a single act of the divine will. God need not even have become man. For having become man, He need not have suffered. The grace could have been given to us by a single act of, say, God becoming man, if He decided to become man, which was not itself, strictly speaking, necessary. But when you shift your focus, and this is what I'm trying to do, from salvation to sanctification, where holiness has degrees and degrees and heights and heights, then, knowing that God did only what must have been very wise, we cannot conceive any other way in which He would either have evoked the generosity from others, or in this we are not sure, but we may safely say we're speculating, the grace of sanctity was merited by the cross. I'm saying more than meets the ears. In other words, the grace of salvation might have been, we're speculating, this is theological speculation now, might have been gained without the passion and the cross. But the extraordinary grace, and how well we know this, how much grace we need, even to survive in this religious life, let alone really become holy, right? And nobody is kidding anybody. This requires a great deal of grace. Very well, very well. It was by His passion and death that the kind of grace was merited as the sanctity requires. All we've got to do is compare the New and the Old Testaments. And one reason for the kind of, we don't like to say unsanctity, but very ordinary, what shall we call it, goodness. When you read David, you know, the great man of the Old Testament, and he was very pleasing to Yahweh. Then you read about his wives and concubines, you say to yourself, well, I guess they had a different ethic in the Old Testament. They sure did. And you compare that with celibacy in the New. Clearly, this takes grace. A problem with a lot of Americans is to keep from their wives and concubines. And we come along, and we are the New Testament, right smack in the middle of an unbelieving world. They don't know what to make of us. Well, we need grace. Merited by the cross. That's one observation. There is one more, and that is this matter of being generous towards God, where we cannot benefit Him, obviously. We cannot give Him anything from which He profits. Well, no. Nevertheless, the Word remains. And it's the Word that the Holy Spirit chose, but not just the Word, but the whole concept of extraordinary love. We cannot benefit God by our generosity, but we can please God. Now this, of course, is a mystery. And here is where we must distinguish between the word want and the word need. In human generosity, that is between human beings, when we are in any way generous towards another person, what do we really satisfy? We somehow satisfy some kind of need. Right? Indeed, if the person has no need, on this level, can we really speak of being generous? Well, we can, but it's a little lopsided, because the whole notion of being a benefactor is that we've done the person some good, right? At any rate, this is between human beings, whereas when the object of our generosity is not a beneficiary, as God cannot be. Can God be a beneficiary of our generosity? No, no hesitation. He's infinite. Does God have any needs that we can fulfill? No. Does God, however, have wants which we can meet? Yes. We're dealing with mystery. We've come a long way, sisters, when we reach this point. He does have wants, and in our human vocabulary, we express it by saying that he is pleased. Do we have some analogy to this, even among human beings? Is it possible to be generous towards a person? I come back to my previous question. Even though I cannot benefit the person. Well, yes. Now, this is a rare person, believe me, who has everything. You tell me of such a person, correct? That does not need anything. But at least we can conceive the notion. Who, at least on the level of our generosity, say it's money, doesn't need it. Can the person, however, appreciate our generosity even though he doesn't need the money? How? He is pleased with our willingness to give. All right? To think of him. Now, the very fact that we thought of him satisfies one of his human needs. You see? So we're, in other words, we're at the edge of Everest, and we look up, we can't climb it. See? But as far as our human understanding of what generosity, even towards a person who does not need what we want to give him, makes sense, doesn't it? So, how can we be generous with God? Even though he needs nothing, he is pleased with our willingness to give. Well, I should be finished because we've gone on for 50 minutes. Let me just briefly say a few words about how to grow in generosity towards God. We begin with the postulate, and this is essential, that not all are called to the same level of generosity. Now, this is a postulate of our faith. The faith teaches us this. All we've got to do is look at the suffering in the world to see how much some people are called upon to be generous in a way that others are not. So that's a postulate of our faith. But we must make it. I would like to address myself to the highest kind of generosity so that we're not talking about too many things at once. The first step towards the practice of the kind of generosity that I dare say we have all been called to, the Church tells us in her writings on the religious life. We've been called to the apex of generosity. The first step is to know oneself. That means to know from experience and the study of one's desires. I'm talking about spiritual desires. If the grace is there. Now, we as religious should assume it is there. But let me tell you, sisters, there are some people who don't know themselves well enough to be convinced they've got the grace. And unless they're convinced they've got the grace, all the exhortations and retreats and conferences are so much water off a duck's back. A good figure of speech. It's useless. They know what you're talking about, but they'll tell you if you ask them or they volunteer the information, you're talking about somebody else, not me. First then, self-knowledge that I have been or I can be, and it may be that by now I have been so negligent with grace, there may be a lot of this scouring that I'm talking about. You may not like me, sisters, for all that I'm saying about John the Baptist, for example, except he happens to be my patron. I like, of course, John the Evangelist, but the Baptist is my patron. My birthday is the 18th, and his was the 24th. That's as close as my mother could make it. So first, we've got to know ourselves, which means knowing how much grace we've got, and be sure we've got this kind of grace. Second, assuming the grace is available, one must sincerely seek to reduce the obstacles that lie in the way. Lie in the way of what? Lie in the way of the use of this grace. What are they? We've talked about them. Sisters, I'm trying to be logical in these six classes. These are our unruly desires and fears. Face them. Identify them. Work against them. Three imperatives. First, of course, know them. Then face them. Identify them. They may be scary. Identify them. Not somebody else's, but yours. And then work against them. That's all you do with an obstacle. That's what an obstacle is for, to be removed. Sisters, remember that. That's the nature of an obstacle, to be removed. No problem. Except the problem of removal. That's step number two. I've got these things. I'm always counting things. Step number three. Study in prayer the life of Christ on two levels. In his historical stay on earth as revealed to us in the New Testament up to the Ascension, and in his mystical life on earth in the lives of his generous followers. I consider it indispensable to study the life of Christ on both levels, historically in the person of Jesus of Nazareth and mystically in the persons who have followed him closely, which is one reason why God has so blessed your community and in having given you a man whom you can well study. But not only him, all right? It's the life of Christ as lived out in those who were close to him. We need it. And the word is needed. We can't do without it. The Gospels are not enough. It must be the Gospel of Christian hagiology, of the saintly men and women who then become our patterns, with whom we can identify our leaders, or beacons of inspiration. That's step number three. Step number four. Keep in Christ's presence as much as possible. So that he may continually reveal to us his calls, that's plural, to generosity. In other words, whatever you call it, recollection, God's presence, virtual prayer, all kinds of theological names can be given. Intimacy with Christ is absolutely necessary. Otherwise, when we are given the opportunity, we will miss it. Often they come on the spur of a moment. And He's got to be right there to tell us, this is it. Fourth, respond to these opportunities to be generous. Otherwise, you'll remain on the level of theology, which may be very satisfying to the mind, but quite useless as far as pleasing God is concerned. Respond to them. And I would suggest two things with spontaneity. People who are, you might say, too reflective or go into a brown study, go into a huddle with themselves. Should I or shouldn't I? Well, by that time, the opportunity will be passed, and, well, it's a pleasant memory. So with spontaneity, but also with peace. Now, this takes practice. In other words, that you're not troubled when you do it, or if you've done it spontaneously and it's bothersome, well, check that. That's not the way to act, because generosity should always bring serenity. One last observation. Be convinced. Keep telling yourself that such generosity has a great reward, not only in heaven, which we are confident we'll get there, but also on earth. First, in spiritual joy, we shall be as happy as we will be generous. Or as Revelation tells us, and the Hebrew word is the same, God blesses those who bless Him. Same verb, barak, barak. Those who please God, He will please them. And when God pleases us, you know it. And secondly, efficacy in working for souls. In other words, God will use us as His instruments in the degree of our generosity towards Him. We'll have to be around, but that's about all. He will do the most incredible things to instruments that don't resist, in fact, that are desirous to just do His will.